From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It was the ever-present prospect of dying a random, senseless death that made Beirut so frightening to Tom Friedman. He covered Beirut for the New York Times, then became the Times' first Jewish Jerusalem bureau chief. On today's Fresh Air, from Beirut to Jerusalem, with a reporter who won two Pulitzers along the way. Also, we talk with Emmy-winning director and designer Drew Takahashi. He's animated MTV logos and directed videos and commercials with Bobby McFerrin. Jazz historian Lauren Schoenberg demonstrates the influence of tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans by staging a tenor battle between Evans, Coleman Hawkins, and Lester Young. And if you're looking for a good scare, Ken Tucker has a couple of home videos to recommend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Tom Friedman won two Pulitzer Prizes during his years covering the Middle East. Friedman's new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is about his journey between these two worlds and how he understood the events and the people he met along the way. He writes, on one level, this book is about a young man from Minnesota who goes to Beirut and confronts a world for which nothing in his life had ever prepared him. On another level, it's about a Jew who was raised on all the stories, all the folk songs, and all the myths about Israel, who goes to Jerusalem in the 1980s and discovers that it isn't the Jewish summer camp of his youth, but rather an audacious and still unresolved experiment to get Jews to live together in one country in the midst of the Arab world. Friedman was UPI's Beirut correspondent from 1979 to 81. Then he joined the New York Times, for which he covered Lebanon until 1984. From Lebanon, he went to Israel, where he was the Times' first Jewish Jerusalem bureau chief. This year, he moved to Washington, D.C. to cover the State Department and foreign affairs for the Times. When the Times sent Friedman to Jerusalem, they dispensed with their own unwritten rule that Jews shouldn't cover Israel.
Well, I think they realized that in this day and age, it was an anachronism. It was an anachronism in any day and age. But I think they realized that some of the insecurities that maybe the paper felt about being perceived as an overly Jewish newspaper and somehow wouldn't be able to report objectively from the Middle East, that it had overcome that. And given the fact that I had been in Beirut for 4 years and had reported in a way which was recognized by many people as fair and objective, I think they felt very comfortable sending me to Jerusalem.
I think one of the stories you became very emotionally involved with was in 1982, the massacre at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. You described that as a personal crisis for you.
Well, it was, Terry, because for me it was, I was the only Jew in West Beirut at the time. The Israeli army was surrounding the city, and even though the Israelis were only indirectly involved in the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, it was profoundly disturbing to me. I felt that was not how the Jewish state I had grown to know and love as a young boy should be behaving. And when I went to interview the Israeli commander after Sabra and Shatila, we basically got into a most unobjective shouting match. Actually, it wasn't a match. I was doing the shouting. He was doing the listening, in which I basically said to him, how could you do this? How could you do this to us? How could you do this to me?
In 1982, your father-in-law was told by one of his business associates who lived in New York, that you had become the most unpopular man in all of New York City because of your reporting from Beirut. Did you feel like people wanted to kill the messenger?
Oh, definitely. I mean, even more than Son of Sam, I was told that I was the most hated man. It was most hated man in New York City. Definitely. I mean, part of my whole book, I mean, is part of the dynamic of it is that I am both the messenger and the object of the message. I am both experiencing new sights and sounds and feelings and things both ugly and beautiful for the first time and conveying those to my readers in America. And at the same time, I'm a subject of those, and I'm personally being changed by what I see in Beirut and what I see in Jerusalem. And in reflecting that, in some way, so are my readers. That change was very painful for some people who had certain mythical images of either the Israelis or the Palestinians. And hence, there were some people who wanted to, I'd like to say, stifle the messenger, not kill the messenger.
Mm-hmm. My guest is journalist Tom Friedman, and his new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is about the years from 1979 to 1988, when he covered the Middle East, mostly for the New York Times, and he won two Pulitzer Prizes during those years. You say that you came to think of Beirut as the darkest corner of human behavior, a place where people talk about violence like they talk about the weather. What do you mean by that?
Well, Beirut was it was a jungle. It was a jungle in which not even the law of the jungle applied. The most frightening thing, I think, about living in Beirut was that nobody was keeping score.
Mm-hmm.
You could suffer, and you could suffer some more, and you could suffer still some more. There was nobody keeping score. I once covered a story in Beirut. An apartment building had been blown up, and a woman had come back to the apartment after it had been blown up and saw it, this pile of rubble, and her family was trapped inside, and a dramatic photograph was taken of her being held back by one arm as she reached out with her other, wanting to fling herself onto the rubble. And I covered the story in that scene. And a half an hour later, a car bomb went off about two blocks away from this building, and that lady was blown up. And it always reminded me that in Beirut, nobody was keeping score. It was a city without echoes. Nobody's life reverberated in its ear. You always felt that 5 minutes after you died, your tombstone would be carved up and be used as a sidewalk or someone's doorstep.
Why wasn't anybody keeping score? Because violence had become so common? Because the authorities didn't care?
Yeah, I mean, after 14 years of sustained violence and killing, nobody's life really seems to matter anymore. Dying there is like diving into a pool of water and not leaving any ripple on the surface. Some people like to think that someone's keeping score. I had a Lebanese friend who used to tell me that every time she flew on a plane, she carried a bomb with her because the odds of two people carrying a bomb on the plane were much less than one. So people like to think that someone was keeping score, and people wanted to impose a certain rationality on it. That's why when someone would get killed, people always had an explanation. You know, if the shell landed across the street and blew up your neighbor, well, you would say, well, of course, he lived on the wrong side of the street, or he shouldn't have gone out 15 minutes after the shelling. He should have waited 20. Everyone knows that. In other words, people tried to impose a certain order and rationality on the violence, because otherwise they would be paralyzed. People couldn't accept the fact that the only reason they were alive and their neighbor not was callous fate.
Well, this came very close to you. The house you were living in was blown up. Would you tell that story?
Well, basically, in the first week of the Israeli invasion, as the Israelis tightened their siege around West Beirut, refugees fled from the outskirts of the city into the inner city where I lived and began occupying vacant apartments. And we lived in a very nice apartment house on the Mediterranean, and several of the tenants had been away for the summer, and their apartments were broken into by various Palestinian clans who were looking to find refuge. And basically, they tried to take over our apartment. They were dissuaded from doing so by my assistant, who was a Palestinian. And we decided that I would move into a hotel, and my assistant would put his two daughters into the apartment. So if anyone came and asked for it, they would say, look, we're just Palestinian refugees, too, and we've got the apartment. Unfortunately, other refugees in the building got in a fight over who would get some other apartments, and the group that lost simply went out and bought some dynamite and blew up the whole building with my driver's wife and two daughters, tragically, in my apartment.
You said everybody comes up with a rationale when violence hits their family. Did you find that happened when this apartment was blown up and your friend's family was in it?
No, you know, that was one that I had no rationale for. I realized that it was simply callous fate that I wasn't in the apartment. I had been there earlier in the day. The bomb could have gone off at any time. I just happened not to be around.
It's not easy to cover a civil war. So you found, I think, all kinds of interesting ways to sense what was happening. For instance, You say that your best political analysis was a guy who sold window glass. This was an interesting way of finding out what the climate was like.
Well, that was my friend Riyadh, and anytime I wanted to know what the mood on the street was, I went to Riyadh, because when his window glass business was good, when people were buying windows, it meant they had confidence in the political situation that there was going to be a period of stability and no one was going to be shooting out or shelling out their windows. When people were disturbed or fearful about the impending political situation, Riyadh's business went south. And no one was buying windows. No one was replacing their broken windows. They would use sandwich wrap instead. And old Riyadh was like the Maytag salesman, the loneliest man in town.
And there were fixers who reporters would always go to get things that they need. What did the fixers do?
Well, the fixers basically knew whose palm to grease, when, where, and how to get you whatever you needed. Basically, Beirut was the ultimate a duty-free port. There was nothing that you couldn't get in Beirut. You could get a marriage license, you could get a divorce certificate, you could get a driver's license for any country in the world, you could get counterfeit money, you could get a bar mitzvah if you wanted in Beirut, if you could pay for it. And the fixer's job was to basically interface between you and the chaos and extract from that chaos whatever you needed, whether it was phony tax receipts or phony taxi receipts, they would do it.
You and your fellow reporters in West Beirut prided yourselves on having lots of contacts and knowing who to talk to. But you say when you got really scared when you saw friends and colleagues getting kidnapped, and you realized it was the people who you didn't know and the people who you could never reach.
Exactly.
Who were the real important characters here.
Well, that was really one of the lessons I learned in Beirut, Terry, is that the people who come around and talk to you, the spokesman, and the people who drink with you at the Commodore Hotel Bar, the famous hotel in Beirut, those aren't the people you have to be afraid of. It's the people who lurk in the silence, the people who live in the shadows, who go out and kidnap other people and then go home and quietly savor it over a Turkish coffee. And one of the things I learned in Beirut was to respect the silence and to recognize how little I had really penetrated the society. I learned that lesson one day in the Commodore Bar right after the Marines had left Beirut and the Shiites took over the city from the Lebanese army. I was sitting in the Commodore having lunch about noon when a Shiite militiaman burst into the hotel, walked across the lobby, and took a M16 rifle in his hands and smashed every single liquor bottle in the bar with the butt of his rifle right before our eyes. The bartender knew he was coming, or knew someone like that might be coming, and had hidden all the bottles of liquor actually under the bar and set up a pyramid of Pepsi cans on top. But this guy wasn't fooled. He ferreted out every bottle and smashed them. And all I could think of when I saw that guy was that, wait a minute, he was my neighbor. I was living next to that guy all this time, and I never really knew he was there. My fault, not his.
Hmm. You were in Beirut for the evacuation of the PLO, and you write that you think the PLO got spoiled in Beirut.
Well, they basically got captivated by Beirut. Beirut is a city of illusions. Every night is 1,001 nights in Beirut. It's a city where men pose, a city of amusement park mirrors that make fat people look thin, tall people look short, short people look tall. You can invent yourself and reinvent yourself any way you like in Beirut, and men did. By simply setting up a checkpoint on a barren stretch of road with two teenagers with pistols tucked into their belts, you could be a general. You could be a liberation movement. You could be a political party. The law of Lebanese politics was, I have a checkpoint, therefore I exist. And the PLO was basically caught up in Beirut's charms. It fancied itself as a great revolutionary movement, and it cranked out posters and whatnot. But it, in fact, it turned into a fat, overweight bureaucracy whose officials had their whose officials' rhetoric was as puffed out as their paunches.
Is that how you still see the PLO?
In large part, yes.
Mm-hmm. You also write that you think that the PLO's terrorist acts were relevant, if still morally repugnant, but they were relevant early on when the plight of the Palestinians was being ignored, but you thought that later it just became an end in itself.
Right. I was in no way trying to justify the terrorism of the PLO. I was simply making the point that given the nature of the world in this day and age, they would have been ignored had they not, I think, engaged in these terrorist acts. The problem was that they got addicted to their own headlines. The importance of terrorism for them was that it put them on the world agenda. It forced them, they forced themselves into the headlines and the evening news of the world. But those headlines became a narcotic substitute for real grassroots political action, organization, and hard choices, hard political choices, accepting a compromise with Israel. And they, in fact, got hooked on their own headlines. And when they did, they, I think, got a totally distorted sense of their own real power to shape events. I mean, if the editors of Time magazine are chasing you around the world to get an interview, you, Yasser Arafat, well, then you're going to feel pretty important. You're going to feel that the wind is at your back, that time is on your side. But in fact, it wasn't. It was really an illusion. They confused headlines for heartstrings, really, and attention for sympathy, and it wasn't always there.
Did you ever feel that as a reporter you were doing things that reinforced their glorification in headlines?
Well, inevitably. I mean, when you are there, they are the story. You're caught up with it. You're part of the feeding frenzy. And it's a difficult thing to resist or stand back from when the herd of which you're a part inevitably is charging in that direction.
Well, I want to talk with you more about covering the Middle East, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is New York Times reporter Thomas Friedman. His new book is called From Beirut to Jerusalem. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is New York Times reporter Thomas Friedman. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting on Lebanon and Israel, which he covered from 1979 until this past January. His new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, tells of his journey between those two worlds. Friedman is now the Times' chief diplomatic correspondent, covering the State Department and foreign affairs. Shortly before you left Beirut to go to Jerusalem, you were in your apartment, I think this is in the middle of the night, when your house was getting fired on. So you hid out in the bathroom, which was the only room without windows, and your first impulse was, hey, this is news in the making. Let me call my editor at the Times. Then what happened?
Well, the apartment was being mortared, and there I was in the bathroom sitting on the toilet listening to the women in the apartment below me wail about how they couldn't take it anymore, and I thought, this indeed is news. And I got down on my knees and crawled into my office and reached up for the telephone and started dialing the New York Times foreign desk in New York. And I got about halfway through the number when I said to myself, what are you doing, you fool? This isn't news. This kind of shelling's been going on for 14 years. It just happens to be your neighborhood tonight. But that doesn't make it news. And then I thought to myself, my God, I'm the New York Times correspondent, and I'm being shelled. And it's not news. It's time to go home.
Is that why you left?
More or less.
When you left Beirut, what you actually did was go to Jerusalem to become the New York Times bureau chief there.
Right.
Do you think you had a different perspective covering Israel, having come from Lebanon?
Definitely. It's actually a very good question, because it's something I don't state explicitly in the book, but it definitely affected, I think, how I covered the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And I was criticized for this by some people, and so I'll say it straight out, in some ways, mea culpa. Having been in Lebanon and experienced so much personal violence, for me, that someone getting his arm broken or shot in the leg by Israeli troops did not send me running. My attitude was that this is a this is a tough neighborhood, and everybody here plays by their own rules, and usually their own rules are no rules. And my attitude towards both Israelis and Palestinians was really the same, which was that to Palestinians I would say, look, you want to go out and launch a war against the Jews? All right, well, that's your business. I'll come out and cover it. You want to go out and make peace with the Jews? Even better. I will come out and cover that. But I'm not going to come listen to you whine. You got to get your act together, take your life into your own hands, and reshape your own future. And the same thing I said to the Israelis when they complained about Palestinians, you know, stoning their cars or whatever. I said, look, you know, you want to do something? I'll come out and cover it, but I'm not going to come listen to you whine, all right? I had enough of that. I got better things to do. There are more interesting stories to cover. Not everyone appreciated that attitude, I'll be the first to admit, but that was how I covered the story.
I want to ask you about an observation that you make about the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. You say that you really can't understand the Intifada unless you understand how deeply Palestinians in the Gaza and the West Bank were co-opted by Israel.
Well, I think this is probably one of the more controversial points of the book, my analysis of the Intifada, but I think... As you just said, I don't think you can understand what the Intifada is about unless you understand that Palestinians had been deeply co-opted economically and politically by the Israeli system. The average Palestinian got up in the morning, put on his Israeli-made jeans, drank his Israeli tnuva milk with his Israeli elite coffee, got into a tender to work inside Israel. He spoke Hebrew during the day. While he was gone, his son used Israeli tambour paint to paint anti-Israeli graffiti on the wall. And when he came home, he got an Israeli lawyer maybe to appeal to an Israeli judge to get his son out of jail, etc., etc., etc. I think the Intifada represents many things, but first and foremost, what it represents is that the Palestinians, I think, found themselves suddenly torn. Their bodies belonged to Israel while their minds belonged to the PLO. That is, from the shoulders down, they paid allegiance to Yitzhak Shamir, and from the head up, they paid allegiance to Yasser Arafat. And there was a strain as a result of that, and sooner or later, either their body was going to be adjusted to their mind, or their mind was going to be adjusted to their body. And I think what the Intifada represents, the physical act of throwing a stone or going on strike, was their bodies finally acting like their minds had been telling them.
The impression I walk away with from your book is that you think that neither the Arabs nor the Israelis are really serious about peace yet.
Well, I think that's you've come away with the right impression then, Terry. My attitude is that basically one has to look at the Middle East the same way an obstetrician would look at a couple who come to him and say, "Doc, we've been trying to get pregnant for 40 years. We just can't conceive." And the first thing that obstetrician would do would see if these people are really trying to get pregnant or whether they aren't just saying that while they're in his waiting room and then going home and sleeping in separate bedrooms. And what you have, I think, in the Middle East is quite a bit of that. You have Israelis and Palestinians beckoning America to come over, please help us, be the obstetrician for peace, help deliver a settlement. But the truth is, they say that, but they don't want to get pregnant with each other. They each really want to get pregnant with us. And that's something we have to, I think, be very wary of. We can be the greatest obstetrician for peace, but only when they are really ready to nurture together a settlement. And I don't think we're really at that stage yet.
Why did you end up leaving the Middle East? You were there for a really long time, I should say.
Yeah, I was there for about a decade, and I think that after a while it started to get to me. You start to feel that I've been to this play before. I know how it ends. And I developed 5 rules of journalism while I was in the Middle East that guided me. And I knew once I developed these rules, it was also time to come home. Rule number 1 is if you can't take a joke, you shouldn't have come. Because if you don't have a sense of humor about yourself and people there and understand that they have a sense of humor, you'll go crazy. I learned that rule from a couple of friends of mine who went up to, in Lebanon actually, to the Shouf Mountains to visit a Druze village to interview some Druze soldiers there. And they were riding in a taxi. There were 2 American journalists, one from the Dallas Times Herald, Bill Barrett, and one from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Dave Zucchino. And as they were driving into this village, they accidentally drove through a Druze checkpoint without seeing the men who were lounging by the side of the road. And these Druze hopped into a car and chased down their taxi and drove it off the side of the road. And the Druze gunmen scrambled out of their car and surrounded the taxi and stuck their guns into the car. And my two friends were quaking inside, and one of the Druze gunmen demanded to see their identity cards, and they showed them their ID cards. And by then, the Druze realized, I suppose, that these men weren't a threat, that they were journalists. And one of the Druze said, "Which one of you is from Dallas?" And my friend Bill Barrett raised his hand, and this guy stuck his gun into the car and pointed it at Barrett and said, "Who shot JR?"
That's a great story.
Anyways, that was rule number one. Rule number two is, in Lebanon, never lead your story on a ceasefire because it'll always be over by the next morning's paper. Rule number three is, there are no good guys here. There are only bad guys and civilians. And the minute you start thinking that one side is all white and the other all black, it's time to go home. Rule number four is, never take a concession except out of the mouth of the person doing the conceding. That is, if I had a dime for every time someone accepted Israel or recognized Israel on behalf of Yasser Arafat, or a dime for every time someone agreed to talk to the PLO on behalf of Shimon Peres, I would have been a multimillionaire by today. I learned that what people tell you in private is irrelevant. All that counts is what they'll defend in public. And my last rule, I'm afraid that I developed in the last year, was that the Israelis will always win, the Palestinians will always make sure that they never enjoy it, and everything else is just commentary.
What does that mean?
It means that I really don't see the situation changing. I think that the Israelis will always have a superior force to enable them to sustain the status quo. The Palestinians will always have enough energy and anger to make sure the Israelis never enjoy it, are never able to really relax. But neither side will make the fundamental compromises, I think, that would enable a real fundamental change in the situation.
Since January, you've been based in Washington, D.C., covering the State Department and foreign affairs. Does it ever get frustrating for you having to talk to a lot of politicians and probably bureaucrats to get stories now after being in the middle of war zones?
Oh, definitely. I've gone from covering a street to covering a hall. And from covering a drama unfolding before my eyes to covering a policy that's invisible. I mean, mm-hmm. What is a policy? It's a collection of attitudes, grunts and nods and winks. You know, you can't say, "I saw the policy today. It bled all over the floor. I saw the policy today. It wept before my eyes." I certainly miss that high drama. At the same time, trying to follow the Middle East from here is very difficult. It's what a friend of mine calls trying to play tennis on a vertical court. Because there's the diplomats here, and they have the peace process, and the peace process has its peace processors, and it goes according to its own rules and bizarre logic. But it bears no resemblance or very little resemblance to the reality I know on the land. I mean, tennis is a game that's played on a horizontal court, and that's the game that's going on the land.
Well, Tom Friedman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tom Friedman's new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Friedman is now the New York Times chief diplomatic correspondent covering the State Department and foreign affairs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, photojournalism in a war zone with Newsweek photographer Bill Gentile. Gentile has lived in Nicaragua for the past 6 years. He covered the fall of Somoza in 1979, the turmoil in Panama under Noriega, and during the recent Salvadoran elections, he was with the Dutch journalist who was shot and killed. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Emmy Award-winning director Drew Takahashi. He's animated logos for MTV, Nickelodeon, and the Disney Channel, made award-winning commercials, and directed multiple versions of Bobby McFerrin. Also, jazz historian Lauren Schoenberg plays Herschel Evans, Lester Young, and Coleman Hawkins back-to-back to show just how influential the soulful Evans really was. And Ken Tucker recommends a horror film that he says stands out from the glut of horror films that have recently been released on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Doreen McAllister. The Energy Department today agreed to pay at least $73 million to Ohio residents who claimed they were hurt by contamination from the Fernald nuclear weapons plant. Henson Moore, a deputy secretary, said terms of the settlement were approved late this afternoon by Energy Secretary James Watkins. A U.S. district judge in Cincinnati has scheduled a hearing on the agreement in August. The United States is expressing its regrets today that a military coup has replaced a democratically elected government in Sudan. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
The Sudanese army toppled the government of Prime Minister Sadek al-Mahdi early this morning and declared a state of emergency. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler says there are unconfirmed reports of gunfire in the capital city of Khartoum. There are no reports of any danger to Americans there, although communications are difficult because the phone system is down. The coup was announced on state-run radio by a little-known army officer, Omar Hassam Hamad, who identified himself as president of a new revolutionary council. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler says the U.S. hopes there will be an early return to democracy.
It is critical that whoever is in control take immediate steps to find a peaceful solution to the war and to improve the provision of humanitarian relief.
Sudan is racked by a civil war that has left thousands of civilians starving. Earlier this year, the army demanded an end to the war or better weapons to fight the rebels. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
An American diplomat is being expelled from Czechoslovakia. Authorities are accusing Robert Norman, a political officer assigned to monitor human rights there, of participating in demonstrations. Barry Schweid has more on the story.
The expulsion of Norman, who was due to transfer to another assignment in a month, coincides with the rejection by Communist Party leaders of an appeal by civil rights activists that all political prisoners be freed. The appeal drew hundreds of signatures. The expulsion and the rejection underscore that not all East European countries are moving in the same direction. Czechoslovakia, where a reform movement blossomed 21 years ago and then was snuffed out, is not showing the same inclination as Poland and Hungary to reform the economy and loosen political controls. The State Department defending diplomat Norman said nothing he had done in Prague was inconsistent with his duties. In fact, the department said he's being expelled in retaliation for the expulsion last month of a Czechoslovak diplomat accused of espionage in Washington. Norman's replacement will be sent to Prague quickly. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Today in Poland, at a session of the Communist Party General Committee, Communist leader Wojciech Jaruzelski announced he's resigning as president. Jane Dobia has details from Warsaw.
General Jaruzelski explained he is stepping down because he lacks the support he needs from the Polish people. Most Poles resent his decision to declare martial law in 1981 and the subsequent banning of the Solidarity Trade Union. Jaruzelski nominated Minister of the Interior Czesław Kiszczak as his successor. Kiszczak was responsible for the imprisonment of Solidarity activists in 1981. However, this year, he emerged as a committed reformer. Kiszczak was the communist chief representative at roundtable negotiations with Solidarity. At those talks, plans were worked out for the first partially free elections in Poland in more than 40 years. Party leaders will make a decision on Kiszczak's nomination in the next few days. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Government sources in Argentina say President Raul Alfonsín today gave his letter of resignation to Parliament. Sources say Alfonsín's resignation would be formally accepted July 8th, the day President-elect Carlos Menem is due to take over office. Alfonsín earlier this month announced that the transfer of power would happen before his term expires in December because of an economic crisis afflicting the country. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz historian and bandleader Lauren Schoenberg is with us again today to profile another pioneer of jazz, tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans. Although his career was cut short by his early death, his style influenced musicians not only in his own time, but beyond.
The early history of the tenor saxophone has been neatly divided into three categories for many years now. There was the Coleman Hawkins school of full-tone tenor men who played aggressively on top of the beat. Then there were the disciples of Lester Young, who were more concerned with space and a floating rhythmic sense. The third category contained Bud Freeman and Dick Wilson, whose originality excluded them from either Young or Hawkins' camp. It now appears, however, that the evolution was more complex than that. Take the work of Herschel Evans, for one. Long before it became a fashionable adjective, Evans was the personification of soul. Evans was born in Denton, Texas in 1909 and transcended the Hawkins influence early in his career. Later, he even influenced Hawkins. Evans played in the top bands in Texas, and by the early 30s had found his way to Kansas City. KC was a mecca for the Southwest's best musicians, and Evans soon found himself playing with Benny Moten, the best band in town. Coleman Hawkins was passing through as the featured soloist with Fletcher Henderson's band in 1933, when a now-famous jam session took place at the Cherry Blossom Cafe. There, Hawkins was bested for the first time by the local tenor men Lester Young, Ben Webster, and Herschel Evans. One of Hawkins' greatest solos, Hocus Pocus, was recorded just months after this legendary battle and has been credited with giving birth to the Southwestern style of tenor playing. But a close examination of his playing suggests he picked up those sounds from Herschel Evans in Kansas City. This is Hawkins before Kansas City. And after. After a spell on the West Coast, Evans joined Count Basie's band in the summer of 1936. He was a big factor in the band's success, and after they came to New York, he was sought after for all-star record sessions. His solos on those records, along with the many classics done with the Basie band, have earned him a prominent place in the pantheon of jazz. When Harry James made his first recordings, he hired fellow Texan Herschel Evans as a featured soloist. Here are three of his solos from that date, Life Goes to a Party, Penthouse Serenade, and the 1 o'clock jump. Evans's blues-drenched sensibility was enhanced by his proximity to the Basie band's other star tenorist, Lester Young, and they fed off each other every time they played. Their tenor battles are legendary, and although they are always thought of as musical opposites, listen how cohesive they are on Panassier Stomp. Here's Evans. And Young. Evans Evans's influence on subsequent generations of saxophonists is easily traced. He was a primary inspiration to Illinois Jacquet, whose most famous solo, Flying Home, contains an 8-bar quote from Evans' solo on Texas Shuffle. Here is Evans. And now listen to Jacquet. Jacquet then set the stage for the honking tenor players of the 50s and beyond. By far, Herschel's most famous solo was on the Basie record of Blue and Sentimental. He brought a new approach to the jazz ballad. Evans suffered from a weak heart, and the years on the road, with the lack of proper food and rest, caught up with him in January 1939. After collapsing on the bandstand, he was hospitalized and passed away shortly after, on February 9, 1939, at the age of 30. But through his recordings and his disciples Buddy Tate and Illinois Jacquet, we can appreciate the magnitude of this soulful giant of jazz.
Herschel Evans is featured on some of the early Count Basie Orchestra recordings. Lawrence Schoenberg leads his own band in performances of classic jazz. Their latest album, Solid Ground, is on the Music Masters label. This is Fresh Air. If you zap away from TV commercials, you may be missing the work of Drew Takahashi. He's a San Francisco-based director and designer who's done commercials for Hershey's, Levi's, and for Milk. Takahashi is the co-founder of the design and production company Colossal Pictures. Their clients have included Francis Ford Coppola, Universal Pictures, Hanna-Barbera, RCA, and MasterCard. Takahashi has directed music videos like The Grateful Dead's Touch of Grey and Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy. One of Takahashi's most frequently played recent commercials for Ocean Spray Cran Raspberry features Bobby McFerrin, and if you think it resembles a music video, that's no accident.
It actually was born from a rock video. The first piece I had done with Bobby was a video called Good Lovin'. The album was Bobby overdubbing on himself, you know, four or five times. So I had my talent, and I had to create a visual. I had one guy, and I had five voices. So I played the first half of the video with him and five microphones, trying to keep up with doing all the vocals. And later, to his relief, there end up being five Bobbies. When the agency saw that, they just thought it was because of Bobby's character, just thought he was kind of fresh and fun, a good image for Cran Raspberry. So they took the idea, set it on a beach. The question came up whether we should do it on a real beach, and for technical reasons, we actually shot it on a studio, but it actually was my preference anyway, because it was the ability to create a completely artificial environment that just made it, I think, more frivolous.
Can I ask you a technical question? How do you create five different Bobby McFerrins on camera?
I think a lot of the effects that are done these days are utilize a technique called blue screen, where you put somebody against blue. There are technical ways of getting rid of the blue and inserting a background. It's a technique that I hate, and we managed to get around that for both the spot and the video, and went back to kind of the oldest techniques that were used in the early days of filmmaking, which is basically a matte shot, where you kind of shoot the image for one side of the piece of film, and then you shoot another image for the other piece of film. We ended up taking that basic idea and stretched it a little further, doing it on an all-digital editing system. But really, the idea comes from way back in the early 1900s.
Do you think of ads as good places to try out experimental techniques?
It's a good and bad place. I mean, one, the politics of commercials make it extremely difficult to really play. I mean, there are a lot of people with reputations and products at stake, so you can't be too playful. But on the other hand, I think that in people's search for visual differentiation, they're willing to put a lot of money per second into filmmaking. It's money that goes far beyond what you could get in feature films, even the high-budget ones. I mean, you're sitting there, you know, dealing with fractions of seconds and, you know, minor details of art direction. So, yes, because of the budgets, we can often go real far with things. On the other hand, there's the conservative force of responsibility that often keeps it from being a purely creative process.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else you've done a lot of is logos, and I think the first major logo that you did was for MTV. Now, what was your role in the design of the MTV logo?
Well, we didn't design the logo. That came from Manhattan Design. But I remember when we were contacted to do some IDs for MTV. It was before they had gone on air, and they had no idea how they were going to produce these things. And I remember meeting guys in New York, and they said that they were going to do this channel, and it was all going to be rock and roll promotional videos. And I thought it was a terrible idea, but I thought it would be fun to work on. I had no idea it would turn into what it did. There, let's see. When we first got the logo, it was I thought it was extremely ugly. It was gross. It was, you know, so overly bold, and the perspective lines weren't right. And I think after we worked with it a while, we realized what was good about it. The design is so bold that no matter what you do to it, it's always recognizable. And that gave us a great deal of freedom. I mean, there are corporations that have giant, thick books that determine everything that you can do to a logo and things you can't do to a logo. And, you know, its placement, its size, its color, its context. And here were some guys who were coming to us with a logo and said, you can do anything you want. It's just got to show up there at some point. And so it was real liberating. And they also had such a schedule that allowed us to do anything we wanted with it. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
So what were some of the things you did to the logo?
Well, let's see. We scribbled on it. We put French fries on it to make the TV and put ketchup on it. Actually, we did that as a joke. I mean, after shooting the first logo, it was early in the morning, and we had been up all night, and the logo was down there. So we took some funky material, put it behind. There were some cold French fries from the night before laying on a table. So we just animated those in. MTV later took that and bought it, put a soundtrack, and it ran on the air. We've done it in computer graphics. We've done it as models. We've done it where the logo is not really there. I mean, by placing various objects that from a certain point in space, all the objects line up to describe the logo, although the logo is not physically there. We did a generic logo where the logo just sits there and it has a, kind of a price code sitting on top, and we got supermarket music.
Did the MTV logos lead to doing other broadcast logos?
Well, I think, you know, for a lot of people in broadcast, when they saw what, you know, Fred and Alan, who were the guys at MTV, had allowed us to do, they realized that the ID no longer had to be a big logo that the camera floats around, that they could be mini stories and could be entertaining, almost kind of like interstitial program material. So later we did some VH1 stuff. We did things for Nickelodeon. Now, those are all part of the MTV family, so that was kind of a natural. But then we were approached by the Disney Channel to work with them. And, you know, they more than MTV, I think, looked at it almost as a small form of entertainment, that these things could tell little stories, and they allowed us to go longer than 10 seconds. And so we now are allowed to do little 15- and 20-second pieces.
If you had your way, would you be doing commercials, or would you be doing a different kind of movie making?
There's a real frustration working in commercials because everything is so controlled, as it has to be. I mean, you're responsible to a lot of people, and yet at the same time, there's that kind of wonderful amount of attention you can put into a very short film. So I enjoy doing commercials, but at the same time, I would like to have both. Both the freedom to do certain kinds of things and the budget to do intense short films. And, you know, unfortunately, especially in this country, there's really no market. It's often used to fill spaces between feature films and cable channels and whatever. But, you know, short films are very much ignored here. Just a few weeks ago, I was in Annecy, which is an animation festival in France, where, I mean, you just see all this great stuff that people all over the world are doing. Nobody will see it. And to me, that's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Your company is based in San Francisco, although recently you opened offices in different parts of the country. Are there advantages to being geographically apart from the rest of the industry?
For us, I think yes. I mean, one is that we were not allowed to really, I mean, we didn't work in all those standard houses where we would have learned certain habits and certain techniques. We were up here by ourselves, I mean, in the early days in my basement, just trying to figure out our own solutions to things. And I think in the end, all the technologies have changed, you know, the tools and the toys, I mean, those things change every year. And yet our approach, which was kind of born out of necessity, is what we continue to have to sell. I mean, just looking at problems and not going for the stock answers and trying to find other ways of achieving the effects we're looking for.
Drew, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you.
Drew Takahashi, co-founder of Colossal Pictures. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, do you have more stories tonight from your recent trip to West Germany?
Yes, the concluding report tonight, Terry. We were very impressed in Germany with a new confidence that the Germans have in their dealings with other countries. And at the root of that confidence, one of the things you find is just a great sense of pride in the success of their economy. And this evening we look at how the Germans have become the world's greatest exporters and what the secrets of their industrial success are. They tend to be go high-tech and have the very most skilled workers. Also, we'll have news of what's happened with the HUD scandals throughout this week.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the recent crop of horror films to hit the home video stores, one stands out for our critic Ken Tucker. Child's Play stars Alex Vincent, Catherine Hicks, Brad Dourif, and Chucky.
A lot of new horror films have come out on video cassette recently, but the best of them is Child's Play, a 1988 thriller written and directed by Tom Holland. It's amazing that Child's Play is as good as it is, given its ridiculous premise. The spirit of a psychotic murderer takes over the body of a doll named Chucky, and Chucky makes life miserable for the 6-year-old boy who owns him. In the context of modern horror movies, however, the idea behind Child's Play becomes quite clever. Child's Play arrives at a time when this genre has become flat, literal-minded, and reflexively violent. In most of these movies, explicitness is all. For the filmmakers, special effects rule and characterization is a drag. In Child's Play, however, we meet characters who exist to do something other than be killed picturesquely. There is, first and foremost, Andy, the boy who owns Chucky. An intelligent, sweet-faced little boy played by Alex Vincent, Andy knows that Chucky is evil, but faces a problem as old as the oldest fairy tales. He can't get the adults to believe him. His knowledge and his fear become more disturbing to us than anything that killer doll can do. Here's a typical moment in Andy's desperate attempt to get the grown-ups to understand. He's trying to convince his mother, played by Catherine Hicks.
What's he been saying?
All kinds of things. His real
was a real bitch and got what she deserved.
How can you say something so horrible?
I didn't say it. Chucky did.
Andy, stop it. You know perfectly well that you're making this up.
But I'm not. Chucky's alive. Really, he
Andy,
is.
Chucky. Chucky's a doll. Andy, look! Now, you don't really think that Chucky is alive, do you?
But he is.
Catherine Hicks also does a good job of balancing hysteria and motherly concern without turning herself into one of those schizophrenic sillies that women usually become in horror films. Hicks has never really had a good starring role. Her biggest exposure was as a dolphin scientist in the last Star Trek movie. It's ironic she should do her best acting in Child's Play, which few film critics took seriously. I should emphasize, I guess, that this isn't just a psychological thriller. There's a fair amount of gore here. Chucky is one of those big 2-foot-tall suckers whose plastic face puckers when he talks. He stumps around the apartment pushing people out the window and wielding a butcher knife. In other words, don't you dare rent it for your kids. Other new horror film releases include Deadly Friend, a 1986 project written and directed by Wes Craven. Craven has overseen the best editions of the most imaginative slasher series, A Nightmare on Elm Street, but Deadly Friend is more complicated than any efficient horror film should be. It's got something to do with an evil robot whose brain is transplanted into the head of a woman who begins staggering around with her arms outstretched like Frankenstein's monster. It's full of winking references to the history of horror movies. It's smart, but maybe too smart for its own good.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Wanna play?
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we step into the ring with sports writer Phil Berger. He covers boxing for the New York Times, and he's just written a book on heavyweight champion Mike Tyson. And television critic David Bianculli welcomes the 5th season of Alive from Off Center, public television's showcase for experimental video, theater, film, and dance. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Karen Impola, and Steve Plever. Research assistants from Liz Trubert and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.